come, draw close, and feel the power of the Hearthstone. Your best location for Warhammer Fantasy Battle lore, hobby, and gameplay discussion. Welcome, everyone, to episode 2 of the Hearthstone. Today's episode is a review of the book Drakenfels by Kim Newman. This was the first episode of the Hearthstone that we recorded, so some of the hobby talk talks about what we're doing, and it was actually this summer. Additionally, learned some audio tricks. There were some audio issues, so we hope to have those fixed in the future. As you listen to this, there are two major sections of this recording. The first part is the spoiler-free section, and then the second section has spoilers as we discuss what happens in the book. I will announce this by declaring that we are going into the Drakenfels, which is our name for the spoiler section. So without any further ado, let's talk to our host. Tell us a little bit about how familiar you are with the Black Library.
Sure. My name's Evan. I've only read a couple of Black Library novels. I have a ton of army books and I've read lots of lore through those, but I've probably only read like 2 or 2.5 of the books up until the review for this one.
I go by Hatsa Mike on the Discord server that we have for Warhammer Fantasy Battles that we're all pretty active in. And my name in real life is Mike. And with regards to Black Library novels, I really got into them and probably read about 20. My local Barnes & Noble had a pretty good selection in the early to mid-2000s. And then from there, just kept going. So I'm really happy to be here.
I'm Kerry, and I go by KMRS27 on the server. I've read about 25 Black Library novels for fantasy and dipped in or skimmed another 10 just to fact check lore that I was writing.
My name is Brian, and I'm known as Rule on the Warhammer Fantasy Discord. As far as Black Library books is concerned, I think I've gone through only like 10 or 11, something like that, the majority being Gotrek and Felix, but the book for today's topic, Drakenfels, I quite enjoyed.
I read a couple Black Library books, about 3 before reading the one for this review. And again, my name is Ryan, and I go by KugelFang52 on the Discord. And I guess we should give Evan the chance to say who he is on the Discord since he didn't get to do that.
You know, I'm terrible at following directions, obviously. I go by Durger on the Discord.
And it was not you. Mike added that. It was not on the outline, Mike, and so I'm not sure what problems you're causing.
What else, players, right?
Wait yep. a second.
It just seemed a bit weird to say, I'm Mike.
Oh, well, you know, it gets weird the other way around. I've heard podcasts and people are like going by Discord usernames, and then they're like, wait, who is this? And then they start using real names because they know each other.
Right. It
can be strange. So
I've realized since introducing myself that on our Discord, I'm not actually KMRS27. I'm of the pile of shame. I introduced myself
that's true.
With a handle
yes.
that no one will recognize me.
I changed it a long time ago. Kerry's known for having a significant pile of shame, which does lead us to what Warhammer Fantasy Battle-related stuff have you been up to?
Been working on, so on the Discord, they're doing the summer challenge, the NXL, one of the users on there is hosting the WA, the summer WA. There's like a set requirement of like number of models that you kind of set out, and over 3 months you paint them up and there's prizes. And it looks like there's quite a turnout this year. I think last year was the first year we did it.
Oh yeah, it's massive.
Yeah, yeah, there's a lot of people doing it, but I've been working on that.
What models are you doing?
I'm doing Bretonians again, which is what I did last year. So it's just a continuation of the same army. But I finished up the Prophetess, which is the character model for my particular army I'm doing this year. I'm going to start working on some knights this week, I think.
Awesome.
Yeah, so I've got about half a dozen armies. I mostly play 8th edition. And so, you know, I kind of just jump between things that I feel like painting at the time. And so, you know, maybe over the last year, I've painted some dark elves, painted some beastmen, painted some goblins, you know, pretty typical fare. And I'm not a participant in the WOG, but I support everybody trying to improve their hobby status and their armies. I'm looking forward to seeing all the entries.
I'm on 24/25 armies at the moment. So for the WAR, I threw it out there to the host to pick what should I paint. And given he remembered that High Elves are my least favourite from previous discussions, he nominated them. So dragging my heels a bit, having finished my first three test models for Bithygard. But in me, what other hobby activities? I've been working on an army list for the Southlands based on medieval Ethiopia. Me and a few other guys from the Armies Project server have been working on that for a while.
And do you primarily play Armies Project, or do you do 8th? What do you do?
I play 8th, but sometimes pour Army Project rules over, which means writing Armies Project rules means an awful lot of having to cross-reference stuff because I don't actually use it on the table.
Gotcha.
For my hobby, I feel like I'm behind everybody. I've got the one army, Orcs and Goblins, but I mean, let's be honest, that's the only army you need, right?
Glorious army.
And I am also participating in the WA. Last year, I did a boar-themed orc force, the Bloody Tusk Boys.
It's amazing.
This year, the bad moon is rising a little bit. I'm doing the Night Goblins, a Night Goblin force. So I've ripped all the forest goblins off the Arachnarok, and I've glued little Night Goblins to all of them. And I actually just finished the shaman that's going to be commanding the Arachnarok. I just have to work up the courage to start the Arachnarok.
You're being very humble. You didn't even mention that you won the WA last year.
Yeah, Brian did a great job on his orcs. They were quite lovely.
I appreciate that. There were many great entries, and this year is going to be awesome to see what everybody finishes.
In XL, who hosts it, boosted the number of models that we're doing this year, and so the forces are going to be even larger, and so it's pretty exciting. I'm working as well, like many of you, on my Great WA force. Part of mine is 10 Chaos Warhounds for my Tzeentch army, and I'm using the Griffhounds from the AOS range, and I'm painting them up with this bluish theme, and then different cat stripes and spots and all that stuff. And so they're my Tzeentch Warhounds. So I've been working on them. Then we also have the monthly challenge. And so after those, I'm going to start on some Tzeentch style Zangors riding, I don't know, something from the AOS range, some sort of bird creatures.
They're like counts as skull crushers, right?
Yeah. They're going to be counts as skull crushers. I think they're called Paladors or something like that. I'm just using the birds, not the Stormcast.
Right.
I have to say, the conversions you're doing for the Tzeentch army are just awesome.
Yeah.
There's so many things that are supposed to be on the good guys' side in Age of Sigmar, in the Stormcast, but they're clearly Tzeentch infested.
Oh, yeah. Tzeentch got in. Well, and for anyone who's listening to this and you want to see some of the models, you can go to the look for the Warhammer Fantasy Discord, find it on the subreddit as well, the link to it. And there's a lot of updates there in a channel called NXL's Great WA. A little bit of housekeeping before we get into our book, Drakenfels. You can find all of us on the Warhammer Fantasy Battle Discord. We're all there. If you would like to ask questions for future episodes, you can ask them by just visiting the Discord and tossing questions at me, probably in the appropriate channel. But let's be real, in any channel you can find me in, or where I state what book we might be doing in the future, you can ask any questions about that there. But without any further ado, we are going to start talking about our spoiler-free, right? So we're going to be safe here, spoiler-free section, talking about the book. So let's talk about why did we choose this book?
Isn't it one of the earliest Black Library releases for Warhammer Fantasy? I was under that impression.
It's also one of the most persistent, even though the lore within it since got retcon several times. Games Workshop always had to acknowledge this was a very well-selling book, a very popular book, and so remained sort of one of their staples right up until the end times. You could always walk into a Games Workshop, at least near me, and it would be in their Black Library section.
Did they do multiple printings of it over the years?
We had multiple printings. We had the anthology version that had several printings in and of itself. They'd do a new print run every time they did a new book in the series, some of which were sort of scrapings of different short stories that appeared elsewhere that then got collated. Also, the author actually ended up with quite a successful career elsewhere within both writing and as a film critic. You may have run into Kim Newman as a talking head on certain sort of like horror documentaries.
Yeah, we should probably just mention that Jack Yeovil's a pseudonym that he writes under.
So see, I learned something there. I thought it was, is it not the first book from Warhammer Fantasy? Or is it just one of the earliest?
It's the earliest that was in circulation right up until the end. There were, if you read Kim Newman's notes in the anthology version, because he does quite a nice introduction about how he got into it, but it was really for the money because it was seen as an easy paycheck.
And if anyone's interested in getting the book, I think they actually really recently released an anthology of the Vampire Genevieve omnibus, but you can also get individual books with a couple short stories as well. So those, they've re-released it fairly recently under their, I think it's under their Warhammer horror section of the Black Library.
And for those who don't like the work of actually reading, all of the series has now been released in audiobook format.
All right. Well, let's get to our still spoiler-free comments about what you see this book being about. Who wants to give their spiel on what this book is?
It really resembled to me an adventure novel set in the Warhammer Fantasy Battles universe. Predominantly in the Empire, you have a cast of characters who could really represent a group of adventurers and kind of their exploits within the institutional kind of dynamic of the Empire. You have levels of government that are involved, you have cities, you have great villains, and you have kind of the interplay between these characters and the great villain and how it all kind of resolves in the end.
Great. What about you, Brian? How would you describe it?
It, of course, I think is about Genevieve and her part with the adventurers, but a lot of time in the novel is given to the playwright, Detlef Sierk. He's just a downtrodden playwright, and he's trying to be immortalized in the culture of the Empire. And I don't recall the name of the playwright that he references, but he really wants to be better than him. He takes a commission to write, cast, and perform a story that, you know, it's just unbelievable, of the fall of the Great Enchanter. And it's the book is about his own adventure in that capacity as a playwright.
What about you, Evan? How did you describe it?
So Genevieve, the vampire character in this, it's interesting because the book starts out almost with like a prologue where it's kind of describing their ultimate conflict with the titular Drachenfels. And then the book, like, suddenly, and I wasn't expecting this when I was reading it, it suddenly jumps 20 years into the future. So you kind of get bits and pieces of what happened in the meantime. But there's kind of this like stark jump between timelines, which I was just not expecting. Especially when you start reading it, it very much feels like a kind of by the numbers, almost like a kind of like Mike was alluding to, like a almost like a D&D campaign where you have all these characters and stuff like that. But it turns out that they're not so important when you get down to the end of that prologue chapter. And it's really more about what Brian was talking about, which is the playwright character. And then obviously Genevieve, you know, she doesn't age, so she's pretty much the same. But a lot of the other characters that you see in that prologue have, you know, they've lived whole lives after that. It's interesting. It's a really interesting story. I actually quite enjoyed it.
Gary, how did you describe it?
Well, to pick up the idea of them having whole lives, I describe it as this is a book about what happens to adventurers after the quest is over. But the closest comparison would be something like Alexandre Dumas' 20 Years After, or, to go less obscure, the Blues Brothers. We have a quest, and then we're 20 years later. Everyone has moved on in some positive ways, some in very tragic ways. We're going to get the band back together for a reason. And that reason is we're putting a play on, and we need all the different versions of what happened to make that play as accurate as possible and as human as possible. That means digging into the Empire's underbelly to find what happened to the Bandit King, what happened to the Blade Dancer, what happened to, well, the titular character, the vampire. What do people do after the bad guy is defeated and they get celebrated as heroes? Some people can't actually cope when the quest is over. and some people can, and some people retreat into what they have left.
That says it well. We get to see what happens to all the various characters, many of the various characters, what happens to them after the quest. So I think that's a good way of explaining it here. Really briefly, Carrie, can you tell us how this fits into Warhammer lore?
This is an interesting one because for many years it didn't, and Games Workshop accepted that there was this gulf between Drachenfels and Kim Newman's writing and everything else. Now, there have been a couple of attempts to marry the two. With the release of Total War Warhammer, there was a short story written called The Prince of Altdorf, which essentially says, within the context of 8th edition lore, this is how it fits together. And we're looking at Oswald, one of the characters' father, in that. And so Oswald gets written out of the story completely, but it essentially establishes a new canon. This year, and I didn't know this when I was writing my notes, they've re-released the Enemy Within campaign for Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay, and they have done a new version of how it all marries together. So characters such as Karl Franz's son is now canon again. So anyone really wanting to work out how this fits together has 5 massive lore books for the roleplay to read through. But the long and short of it is, Drachenfels is now canon in broad political strokes, but watch this space because it's quite new that that's the case.
Okay, Evan, you kind of mentioned some of the, maybe Mike mentioned some of the places that they talk about. What do we see? What are factions discussed that people might be interested in?
Mike said it takes place mostly in the Empire, but obviously Genevieve's character, she's of Bretonian nobility. You know, when she was turned to a vampire, she was like at court with her fam as like a 16-year-old girl in Bretonia. They also a few times mention briefly like Kislev, and specifically a vampire character from that region, which I don't know much about, honestly. I wonder if Carrie might know a little bit more about that. And then there's other like small side characters, specifically people that are in Detlef's like troop that are, I believe, from Astalia or Tilia, but it's mostly centered around the Empire.
Yeah, actually, I thought the vampire, the Kislev vampire, the explanation, that we'll talk more about this later, but the descriptions actually lined up with some of the recent ways that I think GW has been taking some of the AOS vampire stuff, more wolfy and bestial.
Yeah, that kind of like almost Russian style aesthetic right. For vampires. Yep, for sure.
All right. Before we move on to the Drachwald, which is our spoiler section, do we have any helpful background materials that people might want to take a look at before they read this book?
I would recommend approaching this book with minimal pre-reading. There are little contradictions within how the world is presented that can stand out if you've done a lot of lore dives before going into this. It's a well-written novel, it stands on its own, and it does work as a good introduction to the world.
We have another question. You will enjoy reading this book if...
I'd say if you like sort of Dungeons and Dragons style fantasy adventure stories, you will enjoy this, simply because it takes that genre and deconstructs it very well. So it's quite a thought-provoking look at what does it mean to be a hero in an adventuring party, really.
I agree. It has some recognizable characters. It has Karl Franz in it, but it's mostly just a brand new cast that clearly have no effect on the lore in general. That's just a good adventure to dive into.
You mentioned it a little bit before, Carrie, that, you know, working in a theater production or whatever, that I think people that work in theater would probably like to read this book too, just because of the like little quirks and ins and outs of that sort of industry kind of come through. They'd probably get a kick out of a lot of the characters.
Great. Then, without any further ado, our journey will take us towards the Herdstone, into the Drachwald. So how does this book begin?
With a hostage situation.
Ooh, tell us more.
We have an adventuring party within which Uli the dwarf has suddenly turned evil, has ripped out the mage's throat with his teeth, and is holding a knife to our protagonist, Genevieve Dudenay.
So this is a NPC. This is the dungeon master has gotten angry at the party and has betrayed them with an NPC. Is that what's...
Yeah, the fellow who came along to carry the bags but didn't have a play... Actually, scratch that. This might be a player character. This might be a player character who is just sick of Genevieve's characters. Schick and decides that... No, I'm going to side with the DM who's been passing me notes. The mage is out of it because he's a bit overpowered. Don't want him throwing fireballs in the finale. And maybe he thought they were going to talk Yuli down, dispel whatever's going on. But no, they kill him. And they're now two party members down.
You know, the beginning of this is actually really interesting because it's kind of brilliant, actually, because you just go straight into it. And it's very confusing. You have no idea who these characters are. And I think it's like, it's kind of mirroring the confusion of the group that they're being like betrayed in that moment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So just kind of a meta sort of intro to the book itself.
I thought it was funny that once Yuli's defeated, of course he, you know, dissolves and isn't an actual dwarf, but the rest of the party still references him as the dwarf to the discomfort of the other dwarfs in the party who insist that, you know, he wasn't a real dwarf ever.
No true dwarf. Yeah.
No true dwarf. Yeah.
Did anyone else have the problem of just like furiously writing down names and trying to remember who everyone is during this section of the book? Because you were like, oh, I'm going to see all these people again.
Right. Yes. Right.
But contextually, if we're looking at it through the lens of an RPG, we join our party one long rest away from entering Ravenloft, to use the classic big scary castle. We've missed most of the quest.
Yeah.
We are at the last bit of breathing space and the last bit of backstabbing before the finale.
Yeah. The only thing we get in this section before it is talking about Genevieve getting recruited by the leader of the group, Oswald.
Oswald von Konigswald.
Yes.
So he is the son of one of the Elector Counts, and therefore is quite a big deal geopolitically within the Empire, but has had to resort to recruiting adventurers because no one would listen to him.
He is inspired to defeat the great enchanter Drakenfels, who's been terrorizing the Empire and the local communities for centuries.
And why does Genevieve go on this? Wasn't it? I'm just trying to remember. Like, I don't actually remember. I think it was because she was bored, right?
Yeah, it was.
She was kind of like, you know, I'm just sitting here. She thought Oswald was interesting. She was like, oh, you know, his blood would probably taste good. Yeah, but I'm bored. Let's just go.
Well, she has a long personal history with the great enchanter Drakenfels. So Genevieve has lived something like 638 years or so at the time of the novel. Drakenfels the Enchanter goes back, if I recall correctly, in kind of a timeless kind of fashion. So
he claims he predates the old ones.
Yeah, so he's been around forever, and Drakenfels had made an appearance in Paravon in Bretonnia when Genevieve was young and had left an impression on her with his... In those times, he had a different aesthetic. He had a different kind of role in the world. He was more active in the world. His undead legions would walk and make appearances in Bretonnia, and him at the head. And the great enchanter Drakenfels, of course, killed her father and a lot of the nobles in her hometown. And so she has a great interest in him and his life and career.
It's worth noting that Drakenfels. Legion of evil, as it were. He has undead, he has chaos mutants, he has orcs and goblins. He basically has any force of destruction that could be put on the tabletop.
He's an equal opportunity villain.
Absolutely.
Yeah, that was a different time, you know, the late 80s, and kind of the divides that we see kind of in modern times between these factions and the Warhammer world, it was a little more confused, it seemed to me, at least when I was first reading the book. It was like all these bad guy factions are, you know, kind of in this conglomeration of evil led by Drakenfels.
Which you normally only see on the good side, right? Like the forces of Sigmar team up with the dwarfs, or, you know, Teclis comes to help with the Chaos Invasion, but it's always just, you know, the orcs are coming, or Chaos is coming, or anybody else.
Right. Yeah, the bad guys tend not to play nice together.
Mm-hmm. You do see this more in these earlier novels. So, but the first section of the Conrad saga, we have, the evil army is coming out of the forest, and you've got beastmen with Skaven prodding them in the back to make them go forward. Mm-hmm. So this idea of evil soup, shall we say.
Yeah. So they are now kind of, after their long rest, going into the teeth of the final battle of their quest, and they're going into Castle Drakenfels. I thought the gate was humorous.
Oh, you mean the warlock that was with them?
Yeah.
Yes.
I actually noted this in my notes.
For the listeners, do we think we want to kind of set the stage of who actually we're talking about?
Yeah, we can talk about who has, one that they maybe liked at the beginning, or someone that they were interested in.
I don't know if I can keep them all straight.
Yeah, I can't remember. I have my list in front of me, and I'm like, wait, who died almost immediately, and who survived? I don't remember.
I don't think it's that important, because a lot of them are characters that are there just to die, and like they don't come back. There are some that return later in the main part of the book, but there are three or four or five that just die.
Yeah.
So we're at the front door, and we could introduce Stellan the Warlock, but he's just exploded. Bits are everywhere.
He's bragged about how the mechanism, the magical trap at the door, is beneath what an enchanter supposedly as great as Drakenfels should be capable of, and so he does his little magic spell to get rid of the trick on the door, and then he explodes.
It was a very D&D thing.
Our party is then going to progress through a few different encounters. I remember there's the gargoyles. They get to see one of the big set pieces from a previous crime against humanity, the poison feast.
Oh yeah. Brian, do you remember that, or do you want to tell us about that?
I do. That was actually one of the more interesting things. It seems we get the first glimpse into Drakenfels as a character with the poison feast, how he swore he changed his ways and repaid debts and got the Crown Prince of Altdorf or something like that to come feast at his castle. And then he paralyzed them and let them starve to death, among other terrible things done in front of them while they were paralyzed. But
tortures and whatnot.
One of the other traps or the spells that was put on them was they just all of a sudden all become super paranoid with each other. And I think that's actually what, there's the assassin character. I can't remember her name.
That was bad.
The dancer. Yeah. And that actually, I think, affects her the rest of her life.
It's funny because Genevieve is trying to figure out which ones of them are normally angry at other ones in the party and which ones are angry in odd ways, thing where you know that there are people that are not getting along, and that's normal. But when whoever it is, when Rudy or when I think it was maybe Manesh started getting angry at someone, that's when it could tell what was going on. And then Genevieve started getting angry. It took Oswald getting them all back together and composing themselves. He kind of led in that way.
Oswald the hero rallies the group.
Mm-hmm.
We are into this attrition of every encounter, we're losing one or two members of the party now. So down goes Vite with gargoyle poison.
Who gets smashed by the traps where the logs come out in different directions?
Wasn't it the bandit king? I can't remember.
Oh, Rudy.
Rudy, yeah. Yeah, it just sounds horrible. Horrible.
Which then means we lose Erzbeth as well, because they're a couple.
But she's injured too, right? Isn't she somehow injured? Or is she just gone crazy by that time?
I think she's just out of it.
I think she just stays with Rudy when he's injured.
Okay.
We have Anton Vet.
He's down with poison. So we're down to three.
Right. Manesh, a dwarf and mercenary.
Oswald and Genevieve.
Right. They've fallen left and right, and that's all that's left. As they get to, I guess, the top of the tower, as they get to what should be the throne room of Drakenfels.
Who, in his best Christopher Lee voice, opens with, "I am Drakenfels."
He actually has a line that I really enjoyed. He says something to the effect of, "Welcome and come in good health and leave behind some of the joy that you bring," or something like that.
"I bid you welcome to my house. Come in health, go safely, and leave behind some of the happiness you bring."
That's such a good line from a villain. I loved it.
Yeah. I think the scene we see when we get into that throne room also shows, again, what type of villain he is. He has windows, and he can see all the domains around his castle, but he has shrines to the various chaos gods. And it kind of suggests or states even that, like, he sees them as amateur. Khorne doesn't really know how to, like, to murder or to kill, right? And like, he kind of sees himself as above the chaos gods. And so they see that, and that's then when he appears.
So in the first round, he's already disarmed Manesh the dwarf.
At least disarmed one arm.
Yes.
Tears apart one arm. Genevieve sees some crazy stuff, knowing that, you know, Drakenfels had been the one that killed her father. She now sees the soul of her father being tortured.
Yeah, she essentially, like, blacks out. You don't actually see the ultimate confrontation.
Yeah, because the story is told through Genevieve. And so, yeah, she, like, feels heavy things on her. What is it that's hitting her or, like, pushing on her? Something like that. And it leads her to black out.
She's being, like, dragged by demons or something like that.
Yeah.
She is taken out of it just as Oswald's getting into the swing of shouting in the name of Sigma.
I mean, that's it. That's what we know, you know. Oswald was able to achieve victory, and that some afterwards saw him as the spirit of Sigmar reborn.
Yeah, we get a very quick summary of she missed the battle. It was important. There were songs about it. He killed Drakenfels. Yay.
I don't know if you know anything about this, Cary, but I can't remember if it's in the prologue, but they mentioned that Drakenfels literally fought Sigmar. I don't know if that's covered anywhere else or...
So Drakenfels got replaced within lore with Nagash, essentially. They went back and used the same idea of let's have replace the Great Enchanter with the Great Necromancer and use a lot of these story hooks for Nagash's career.
Right, okay.
Only room for two bad guys in Warhammer Fantasy, Archaon and Nagash, evidently. All right, so we... Oh, did anyone want to say any more on this kind of part one?
I was just going to say that just to speak on what Evan was talking about, I believe this is how, in this timeline, the confrontation with Sigmar is how Drakenfels ended up with the Iron Mask. Nobody had seen his face since his confrontation with Sigmar.
There was one passage that I really liked where Genevieve is kind of ruminating on, like, her relationship with Drakenfels, and they kind of talk about how she's lived so long, like, she doesn't even really have, like, thoughts of revenge against him anymore. Like, maybe, like, when she was a younger vampire, she would have, like, been more gung-ho about it. But it seems like she almost joined up more out of curiosity than anything. But there's a passage where it says, Genevieve was still walking the earth, and so was Drakenfels. She wondered if he felt the same suppressed kinship for her that she felt for him. There were songs that they alone of all the world would recognize, once famous names that they alone knew, extinct animals, the taste of whose meat they could alone recall. I just thought that was a really interesting thought, like, she's lived so long that she almost feels a kinship with the man who killed her family, you know? I just thought it was a really interesting passage.
Yeah, and that's a recurring theme in the book, is her disassociation from the world in many ways. It's like she sometimes just doesn't, not that she doesn't get people, but she just doesn't really care. Like, they're just so different, and she's so apart from it because she's lived so long that
right.
She sometimes struggles with that. I thought that was good writing.
Yeah, we'll probably talk about it some more, that, like, the apathy that develops from, like, eternal life.
right.
So the blacking out of Genevieve and the confrontation in the throne room is kind of where the introduction leaves us, and we kind of enter a new phase of the book, Act One.
We now jump forward 20 years, and we are introduced to another character, but this one will be someone that we get to be with the rest of the book, Detlef Sirk.
Detlef was just out of left field with when this character is introduced. You're already kind of reeling from the time skip and the end of the adventure and how that ends. And then you're just transported to Munsen Keep with Detlef Sirk, who's in debtor's prison in some capacity for the failing of his previous play as a playwright, where he was going to tell the Epic of Sigmar where at one point he was going to have the audience watch in silence for 2 hours as he stood in the center of the stage as Sigmar Silent and goblins surrounded him until he lifted Sigmar's hammer and gave a speech that would have roused the whole audience. I can't imagine why that play failed.
You forgot the goblins were going to come on one at a time in individually designed masks.
Yes,
right.
For
well,
2 hours.
And you have to remember, too, that he originally wanted real goblins, and they said they couldn't do that.
but they couldn't do that more because of racial discrimination as opposed to they're evil, we're not going to have them anyway.
Right.
Again, this is earlier Warhammer lore. It's right. More gray area when it comes to good and evil.
Yeah, the Actors Guild didn't want to use goblins or something.
Yeah.
Yeah, Detlef's quite a character. He's known in the keep for the amount of money that he got into debt for because his play fell apart and everybody else kind of scattered and turned on him and said, you know, he should be the one to owe everything. And so does anyone remember or have handy exactly how much he owed that all the other prisoners also know? Cause they're amazed by him owing this much money.
Yeah, I've got it. It's 119,255 golden crowns.
Right. So he's very in debt and no way of getting out of it. Although there's someone offering to pay him like a penny, a line for music or a play or something.
They make a point of saying his age. So when Drakenfels died, he was 4 years old. So 20 years later, he's in prison for that amount at the age of 24.
And basically the entire thing seems completely hopeless, right? He's in debtor's prison for an amount that is just so astronomically large that there's no way that he could ever pay it off in any capacity. So he's basically looking at life in debtor's prison with his lovely cellmates.
He kind of sees his future as one of the other prisoners is going to keep stealing from the weakest member of the prison cell until they die. And he figures he'll be the third weakest. And so he's only got a couple more people before he dies.
We have Detlef sharing a prison cell with six other characters by my recollection. Zaradat the turnkey is kind of the most infamous. He's kind of Detlef's enemy in prison because the turnkey kind of has a lot of power and authority and can make your life a little more miserable.
At this time, we're reintroduced to Genevieve, and we actually get a lot of kind of early vampire lore, or at least Kim Newman's version of vampire lore, as Genevieve has gone to the convent of the Order of Eternal Night and Solace.
There's a little bit of lore we get from there. Genevieve has almost lost the urge to drink. I guess vampires, if they don't, I don't know if it's like riding a bike or something, but after time, they just kind of lose the urge to drink. I don't know if that's still canon. Do you know,
that's
Carrie?
Not still canon. Definitely not still canon.
Okay.
We also get a little bit, it's probably like a early differentiation between like vampire bloodlines, because she talks about, you know, essentially like Strigoi versus like her like more normal vampire.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the ones that are I think she called them truly dead. The truly dead are kind of the wild Strigoi like vampires, and they are ones that give vampires a bad name by going out and, you know, ravaging villagers and doing all that, you know, blood drinking and stuff like that. She seems more of the civilized sort.
We get some quite good physiological variety.
There's also a dwarf vampire.
So we've got we get a vampire dwarf, only one I'm aware of in the canon. We get Wheatzak, who is one of these truly dead Strigoi, but is described as a giant, not a literal giant, but who ruled Carrick Vaan for some time, which is the only time this has got that this is ever mentioned in lore. But it's a ruined dwarf hold that the goblins and Skaven fight over, and the dwarves occasionally try and reconquer.
This seems more of this evil mixing together, right? That this vampire would rule over it when there's Skaven and Greenskins there.
Did it make anybody else just laugh, the idea of a convent of vampires? I just, I like it. I just laughed. I was like, that's such a funny idea. They're like bored playing like gin rummy on the balcony.
And this is where we get some of Genevieve just being separate, bored from life.
Yeah.
You know, is not going to take part in the politics anymore. She's just kind of done with all that. Until an envoy from Oswald shows up.
Yeah, she's having a conversation with her, like, mentor, who's a 12-year-old girl.
Who's also her grandmother.
Wait, is it her literal grandmother?
No, no.
Okay, I was like, what? She's 12. How would that work?
So it's the sire of her sire.
Yeah, I gotcha. Yep. Yeah, through vampire bloodlines, she's grandmother.
I believe the book mentions that Genevieve is a Lamian.
Did they actually use that terminology?
They refer to her bloodline being from Lamia, but then obviously later lore, all vampires are from Lamia if you go back far enough. So It's whether you view this as she is a literal Lamian bloodline depends on how you interpret it.
I didn't know I was opening a controversy.
Eighth edition canon would be that she is a Lamian, but we will not bring in end time stuff yet.
Oh no, we'll avoid that as long as we can. Don't want people stopping right now and no more listening because we mentioned end time. So she gets recruited and she decides she's interested in going. We meet Maximilian. Let's briefly. Maximilian of Königswald, who would like to cover Mr. Eggs?
So he's the father of Oswald. He's kind of like doddering old man at this point, who's not in good health. And he has like a nurse that's with him all the time. But I think this part of the book is actually one of my favorite parts because there's like a whole like meta moment where this character, Maximilian, is literally playing Warhammer. Like with metal figurines on his like wargaming table in his, you know, in his keep. And I just was like laughing so hard at it. And it's like he's kind of losing his grip on reality. So he literally thinks he's like a general on the battlefield commanding these little miniatures. And it just like, it was so funny as a, you know, a war games player to have a character that's kind of doing that in the book itself.
Really tell me fun. You've never lost yourself in the war game and thought you were General Heaven.
Well, we'll talk more about it later, too, because it comes back at another point. But that, I think that's when we first meet him is that kind of meta moment. So, but it sets the stakes for Oswald because it kind of sets up that he is the heir apparent to his father's elector position. So.
He wins his Warhammer game by pouring burning brandy onto the opposing army and melting it.
Yeah, yeah.
Which means the orcish commander starts crying to his grandma.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, the opposing player is, what, like 9 or 10 or something?
It's like his nephew or something like that.
Mike has actually done that when we've played before.
He's made children cry.
So, just so you know.
And while the book largely portrays Maximilian as kind of an old and infirm and kind of mentally not there with it anymore kind of guy, apparently he was, you know, back in his prime, quite the champion of the Empire and
right.
Someone that the Empire really depended on to lead their armies.
Good soldier of the Empire. Yeah.
So, he's a bit of a joke now, but, you know.
He was important, yeah.
When he wasn't. You know, very old. He was.
Yeah. At later points, they'll reveal that like he was kind of the right hand man that helped Karl Franz to end up being the next emperor. Like,
I think that does connect later for a reason we'll get into. But
yeah. All right. So after we meet Maximilian, we go back to Detlef, and we'll briefly. There's a number of people that are reintroduced. Mike. We come back and Detlef is in the keep and it's looking like he's not going to survive. And then something happens.
Yeah. So we come back to our friend Detlef and he's in Munson Keep. He gives a pretty good sense of humor about things though. And one day he's surprisingly visited. It turns out to be our friend Oswald von Königswald. He's in his late 30s to early 40s and he's quite influential in the Empire. Oswald von Königswald comes to Detlef, asks him to write a play, put on a production that is going to tell the story of Oswald von Koenigswald defeating Drachenfels, and it's going to be one of the largest, most grand productions probably put on in a generation or two. And Detlef agrees to do this. Oswald will pay his debts, pay his investors back, and get him out of Munson Keep in the near term and the long term. Detlef jumps at the opportunity, and when he does that, he kind of does a little bit of payback to the people who've wronged him. The governor of Munson Keep, he kind of takes over his quarters and, you know, basically gets him fired and
throws out his paintings.
Right, and the turnkey, he basically sets him free, knowing that he's going to mess up again and be back in Munson Keep, and he's going to be at the bottom of the totem pole. So it's kind of, you know, maybe looks like a good thing to be released, but, you know, it kind of has a more sinister kind of motive behind that. And troubles, which seemed completely uncorrectable, or suddenly corrected by this wealthy and generous patron company.
I thought it was funny when they talked about his original production that he was in debt for, and how like a plague swept through it. And all I could think was like, oh my God, COVID's like canceling events written in Warhammer novels from 30 years ago.
Yeah, and this is first where we start to see things that are, oh, wow, that's interesting. Like, there was a plague that went through that production. What a random event. That was bad luck, right?
Yeah.
You start to question in your mind, like, are these things maybe, you know, interrelated?
They quote the production as having sort of 1,000 actors and entertainers involved. And in early modern sanitation, if you put 1,000 people together to put on an open-air production, you're probably going to have some form of plague.
Imagine right. If he got his real-life goblins.
Well, yeah. It's even worse if he'd gotten Skaven.
So then do we get essentially a few chapters in a row about them, like, trying to get the people, like we were talking about earlier, get the band back together? And
yeah.
Because Detlef wants to do, like, the most accurate, faithful retelling of this tale as he can. So he needs all the people that were alive and there to, like, give their accounts, essentially.
Right. So he's trying to get everyone. Before he does that, he has to have the most beautiful actress to be Genevieve.
Lily Nissen, yes. The Marilyn Monroe of that era. She is the most well-known leading actress in all the plays of the Empire. And in more hushed circles, she's had affairs with a number of the Elector Counts of the Empire and is looking to complete the Empire. The relationship between Lily Nissen and Detlef is actually pretty entertaining throughout the book. In public, they're cordial, at least for the most part. But in private, they both just hate each other. And there's a bit of levity in the book from both characters about how they just trash each other in private to their confidants. But I believe Lily Nissen is actually invited to be a part of the play by letter from Oswald, which is something she throws back in Detlef's face. You know, if I wasn't invited personally by Oswald, I wouldn't even be here amongst such second-rate actors and all that type of stuff.
Yeah, total diva.
Yes, 100%.
Absolutely. And there's kind of a little bit of interesting stuff about how she can almost turn her charm off and on. Like, she can, when people don't see her, when her charm on, like, they're not attracted to her. She's ugly. They see her for what she is. A diva, cruel, all that. And then she can just like switch and her face is suddenly lovely and men just want her. We're also introduced to some others.
We reconnect with Rudy Wegner, who was the king of thieves 20 years ago. And now he's a Barney from the Simpsons style character propping up a bar, offering to tell his story of his adventures for drinks. And specifically gets told, I will buy you a drink if you never tell us that story. We've heard it enough. We don't believe it. And then into this walks Oswald to recruit him. And you do have the implied jaw drop.
Right. Who else do we meet?
There's Erzbet, who was the dancer assassin. And the last we saw of her, she was with Rudy after he'd been injured in the castle 20 years ago. And as we talked about earlier, there was some sort of like spell or something that was cast on them that made them go crazy, at least briefly, except it never wore off on Urzbet, and she's basically been in an asylum, I believe, since they left Drakenfell's castle. She's just like completely gone. There's really nothing of her left. And she gets an order for release, I believe, from her asylum. So essentially she's released and like on en route to, you know, being reunited with Party or whatever. She like kills her guide and herself.
Comes down to the well-meaning priestess gives her a memento as she's leaving. You know, doesn't think anything of it, and
right,
the superior never tells the sister who did this that, oh yeah, she used the pin on the back of that, rip out the guy's eye and then kill herself. But you do find out that from her name that her and Rudy had got married before she was committed.
Oh, yeah. I guess I didn't notice that detail. Yeah.
You do find out this chapter that Genevieve has been funding her placement in the asylum.
Yes. Yep, I remember.
In spite of the fact that some of Erzbeth's greatest vitriol is against Genevieve.
Yeah, yeah. It gives you almost a little bit more into Genevieve's character. She's able to show like pity to people like that,
right?
Despite you know, her
general detachment.
Yeah.
So once everybody starts getting together, Detlef's getting the play going and everyone's acting, and he's cast Manesh in this play, but there's someone else who is trying to get the role of Manesh, and it's Manesh who wants the role of himself. And you know, he says, you know, well, it's going to work perfectly because I've only got one arm, and the actor trying to play me actually has two arms.
Can't argue with that.
Yeah, so then we were reintroduced to our character, Anton Vett. So Anton, at the time of the downfall of Drakenfels 25 years ago, was a great bounty hunter who was known for caring for his weapons and being very professional and expert at his craft. And we find him 25 years later, and the reintroduction story is of him bringing in a bounty to a vengeful lord. And at this point, Anton is older and out of shape. He's probably in his 40s or 50s. He has to shoot his charge when he's trying to escape. And he meant to shoot his charge in the leg, and he accidentally kills him by shooting him in the neck. So we kind of see, you know, a 25-year gap and kind of a decrepitation of Anton's abilities and his faculties as a bounty hunter. And we kind of learn that he's also dying of basically lung cancer. Oswald reached out to him, and he's paying him to talk to Detlef about his story.
I don't like the strays that I'm catching for being in my 40s from Mike, assuming that people in their 40s are out of shape and can't catch people when they're a bounty hunter. So thanks, Mike. But
I need to mention that Detlef pulls all of those debtors out of prison really just to lord it over them, but also to repay some debt, repay some of the kindness and the not stabbing him in the back.
Right. Certainly the carpenter that he pulled out of prison that wants nothing more than to be in the play, right? He's always trying to like find a way into it.
Yeah, I don't know that we've done a good job of really explaining Detlef's like unique kind of personality, you know? So if somebody wants to do that, that's probably...
One thing I did think that was interesting about Anton is... he actually specifically says that he remembers Oswald as a snot-nosed boy, which was exceedingly different than how Genevieve had explained Oswald in the introduction as being the one who like led them and kept them all together. And I thought that was, I don't know, that was striking to me when he said Oswald was a snot-nosed boy when they had originally been together, because it seemed out of character with what we'd been told. Nevertheless, one more character important to the story is also cast at this time. So tell us about Laszlo.
Laszlo Lowenstein comes to audition for the role of Drakenfels within the play. At this point, Detlef has started getting a bit more of a structure going on. He's got an assistant who he can bounce ideas off. And Laszlo walks in and presents his audition piece, which is written by Taradash, who is Detlev's idol of who he wants to emulate and surpass. He does his bit. He's got a good stage presence. He's very intimidating. And Detlev has a chat with his assistant director, Varga Bruegel, who is a dwarf who's not a dwarf, aka so he's just a general human with dwarfism in a world where dwarves are a race, which gets very confusing, and so he doesn't fit into either category. And they cast Lowenstein, who then goes off, happy to have been cast, and reports back to a mysterious fellow in a mask that everything's going as planned. Now, given we've already established Drachenfels' signature of wearing a mask and having a masked face as his exploding trapdoor knocker, there's sort of this implication that this is all interconnected. But this masked figure has recruited Lowenstein by catering to his special interests, which are heavily implied to be, here is an innocent chained up in the next room, do what you like with them, and we'll get rid of the body. It isn't said exactly what he's doing, but it is explicitly said that without this support, he'd have been hung a number of times over.
Yep. So everybody now is at Oswald's castle and gathering together, getting ready, and they have decided that they will have the play, of course, at the old castle Drachenfels, named after Constant Drachenfels, the enchanter. And, you know, if that sounds like a really, really dumb idea to you, it is one that when you read it, you say, yes, this is a really dumb idea. And they even say, you know what, they probably should have torn down the castle Drachenfels, but they didn't. So they were going to go have the play there. This is when Detlef is warned by spirits that tell him, you must go no further into the darkness. Detlef immediately says, yep, I'm out. And he decides to leave. But ultimately, Oswald arrives and convinces Detlef that everything is okay. And you know, nothing amiss is going on. And so they all travel to Castle Drachenfels together. All right, so they're on the way to Drachenfels, Castle Drachenfels, and there's some odd things that happen.
So on the way to Castle Drachenfels, it's, as we touched on earlier, Erzbet, the dancer assassin who was originally with the party when they confronted the Great Enchanter 25 years ago, she's been killed in a murder-suicide type of situation, and our new character, Laszlo Lowenstein, who's going to play the Great Enchanter Drachenfels in the upcoming production, he's kind of under mysterious orders to collect the eyes from her corpse and her heart as well. We have the party moving between Altdorf and Drachenfels Castle. We have some other kind of mysterious shenanigans going on with a number of wagons that are in the production company's party. So it's unclear. There should have only been 26 wagons, but there's a 27th wagon, kind of a mysterious kind of, you know, when they count things, it like doesn't really add up correctly and no one can really explain it. And so we kind of are left with that mystery there.
There's some levity actually in that situation where they keep going back and forth, like recounting them and like can't figure it out. And like, I don't know about you guys, but I've had this happen in real life where like you've counted and recounted something multiple times and you're getting different numbers every time and it's like driving you insane.
Is it when you're making an army?
Yeah, right.
An army list, you're like, wait, I swear this was only 2500.
Yeah, exactly.
When you're rolling dice in Warhammer, you gotta cut them into like threes or groups of threes or sixes or something.
That's it.
You can't do it one at a time.
We also get some good character development on the journey. One of the themes that I think I saw was that the way that the different characters presented themselves is not necessarily who they were. So this idea of memory, which makes sense with, you know, Oswald is doing this play to remind everyone of his greatness and what he did. But one person that this occurs with is Rudy. We see Rudy dealing with untruthfulness about who he was as like the bandit king, which is what he presented himself as. Maybe not quite a Robin Hood figure, but like kind of...
It was romanticized, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And he remembers a story and it's very clear that like he wasn't noble and it wasn't valiant. frightened as people were getting killed, and he was terrified as he killed people and robbed them, and how horrific that was. So I think it shows a lot of development in that way. I think we also have some development of Detlef.
Yeah, ever since the start of the book with the introduction of Detlef, he's always talking about wanting to continue his genius, continue, you know, be immortalized. He wants people to recognize him as a genius. And at this point in the story, it's almost like he's using that to push him forward, to complete the journey. You know, once the ghosts show up to deter him, he kind of is able to rally himself by the promise or the hope that he's going to be immortalized as this playwright. And his arguments with Lily Nissen are reconciled with that hope to eventually come up. And that kind of takes him through the rest of this journey. His vanity kind of delivers him to the doorstep of Castle Drachenfels.
Yeah, and with Lily, how is it that they speak? They only talk to each other through...
They speak through her astrologer, actually.
Yeah, going back and forth between them.
It's very middle school.
Yeah. No, I didn't have an astrologer in middle school, but okay.
Well, you get what I'm saying.
So ultimately, most of the party arrives at the castle, Drachenfels. It's been weird, and so there's some down people, so... what happens after?
So our first night in the fortress, Rudy Wagner, he throws a party. He's kind of always been someone who's had an affinity for theater people. He feels like the production has given him kind of some purpose. You know, he was pulled out from a bar as a kind of old, decrepit kind of guy telling stories. And now he's got meaning. He's got kind of purpose being around these theater people. It's given him some life. And as the night drags on, you know, there's been drinking, there's been partying going on, and he's kind of losing his mental faculties. It's unclear if he's drunk or what's kind of going on there. And it becomes more clear that the Castle of Drachenfels is having some effect on him. And he believes that he is following the ghost of Erzbet, his former lover, to a point in the castle where he is then set upon by a mysterious force and he is killed. And once he's killed, he's discovered the next day by the head of security for the production, a character named Henrik Crawley. This kind of throws a whole wrench in the production, and Henrik Crawley notifies Detlef, notifies Genevieve that, hey, one of our party is dead. His body's been desecrated, just like the other adventurers from earlier in the novel who were kind of original members of the party. His eyes are missing.
And his fat.
His fat is missing. And so it becomes clear that these original adventurers, their organs are being taken, and there's some nefarious purpose behind it. Things really kind of take a nasty turn for the production.
At this point, we also, after this, as this is all going on, we find out that Maximilian Oswald's father has indeed died, and he died doing what he loved, which is playing with miniatures. So I think that's something we can all understand. But he envisioned that they were alive and attacking him, and he was a giant. This is very Gulliver's Travels. He's attacked and beset by Lilliputians, and he slowly succumbs and he dies.
He was quite the collector, actually. He was being stabbed by goblin spears. Wood elf war dancers were climbing all over him.
It's rough.
I think we've all stabbed a hand or two on like old pewter spears at one point or another. It's not fun.
Some of us don't use all those old minis like Mike. Some of us use plastic ones.
I do. I cherish old miniatures. But I was going to say, before we let Maximilian leave, I think we have to touch on the subject of his fascination with eggs.
Yes. The greatest battlefield snack.
So the various chapters where Maximilian's present, we kind of have him being taken care of as an elderly person without use of all of his faculties, and a great source of motivation for him to behave himself and to follow his minder's instructions is to have a meal of eggs, which he tends to enjoy. And dream eggs whenever kind of eggs are brought up, or he's able to convince someone to feed him eggs for some sort of task that he has accomplished.
Yes.
that was a particularly good part for people that happened to consume this through an audiobook. The voice actor very emphatically would shout, "Eggs!"
It's great.
A reason to listen to the audiobook over the written. After they found out about Maximilian's death, Rudy has now died. They've discovered him. Henrik Crawley is seeking the killer. And then we're taken back to Oswald, who's not at the castle yet.
So the high dignitaries, so Oswald, Karl Franz, and the other electors, are traveling separately to the help and the actors. And the dignitaries are making their way towards the castle. We get quite an interesting conversation between Oswald and Karl Franz, where Franz makes it very clear that he would have supported his friend and gone on the quest with him, but Oswald never asked him. And this is one of the first indications we get that maybe there was something else going on in Oswald's recruiting strategy. We've obviously established that Rudy wasn't, you know, the noble bandit king that everyone knew about as a Robin Hood type. He was a lot more down to earth than that. So Oswald's motivations and his planning, it wasn't just arbitrary. This wasn't just everyone meets in a tavern. Now, we get the one of my favourite moments in the book, where Karl turns around to the electors and declares that they're going to camp for the night. If you can imagine taking what is basically 12 heads of state out into the woods and declaring an impromptu camping trip, there are some fun reactions here.
We're going on a retreat. Company retreat.
Like, they're all just like totally petrified of being outside.
Yeah.
When you're going through the great forest of the Empire and you could be ambushed by beastmen at any moment, it's not that unreasonable to dislike the camping idea.
Also a good point.
Karl's viewing this as getting away from responsibility of being emperor. He's got his son with him, Luitpold. He's about 12. Yeah, this is a nice bonding moment. And then you wake up the next morning and your son says, "So what were the creepy monks doing hanging around camp last night?" What monks? "Well, the monks. I went to bed and then there were monks hanging around chanting stuff. No one else see them?" Which is the second most creepy thing in this section, because the creepiest is definitely the Elector Countess Emmanuel viewing the 12-year-old Luitpold as a potential marriage prospect.
Yikes.
We're into, you know, European royalty marriage conventions. It's not that unusual to have that kind of age gap, but you're in Karl Franz's head and he views it as a bit disturbing. So nothing ever comes of this. Luitpold goes on to have a very successful career of never being mentioned again until this year in the role-playing, and Emmanuel goes on to be a background character in Tamarkan, and then the shrill, ineffective one in, yes, I'm going to say it again, The End Times.
All right, so we have anything else on Oswald's journey on the road?
That kind of touches on the topic of, like, the bizarre kind of lore and nature of the Empire with regards to, like, people knowing about danger and chaos, but also at the same time not knowing about danger and chaos.
Well, and that gets to Genevieve, that everyone's like, "Hey, she's a vampire. That's okay. She's not bad."
Yeah, she's open about it.
Right, which is very anti-lore of later lore.
We have a mention very early on of a group of younger vampires coming to her, wanting her as a spokesman for getting what is more or less municipal laws changed so there's less discrimination against vampires, which really, you know, we're into the, this is a social class thing where occasionally a witch hunter will knock on your door and shout at you, as opposed to they're all evil and we shouldn't be seeing any sign of them in polite society.
All right, so we'll move on with Oswald and his party, Karl Franz, arriving at the castle. Something happens to yet another member of the original party.
Yeah, Detlef is very paranoid at this point with so many things going wrong with his production and so many murders and bodies turning up that he's taken to become a very jumpy, and I don't recall, but perhaps he was in the middle of barring his door, or he was going to bar his door, but Genevieve knocks and suggests they go for a walk in the middle of the night, because why not? You're in Castle Drachenfels, I guess, and there's been murders. You might as well just walk around at night.
Was the implication that she had an interest in him? Wasn't that?
Yeah, definitely.
A little bit of flirting?
I believe so. There was definitely a mutual interest by this point in the book that she found herself looking less at Oswald and more at Detlef.
Right.
We never touched upon the fact that Genevieve and Oswald are sort of hinted at having been a couple, because when we have the trap that gets everyone paranoid and Oswald snaps her out of it, he snaps her out of it and then kisses her on the cheek.
Right, yeah, that's
right.
There was another area of vampire lore that I quite didn't understand with regards to, like, her feeding versus her giving someone the dark kiss. Like, can you drink somebody's blood but not give them the dark kiss? Is, like, that a formal act or something?
I think typically isn't the dark kiss, like, a vampire feeding someone their own blood? I don't know if that's in Warhammer fantasy, but...
Yeah, it normally involves blood going both ways. I don't recall it ever being explicitly addressed within Drachenfels, if that's what they meant, but let's assume that given the large amounts of vampire canon elsewhere, that's what is meant unless otherwise stated.
She's really interested in drinking men's blood, but not drinking all their blood and just, you know, taking some, though she does mention, like, she's sometimes tempted to take too much. So that's kind of what she's involved in. At this time, when everyone gets to the castle, what happens with one of the other members of the original party?
Right. Detlef and Genevieve are on their stroll at night, and I believe they start to hear chanting echoing throughout the castle, so they move to hunt it down, and they come upon Manesh being mutilated. I believe they decide not to intervene, whereas Crowley shows up with his guard. The lights go out, and Crowley and his people rush in to try to fight everybody off, and there's this big rumble. They're not able to really determine what's going on. There's people swinging. There's the sounds of combat and stuff like that. But whenever the lights return, it's just Crowley and his men in the room. No robed cultists. And Manesh lying on the ground, dead.
With no skin.
Correct. I also want to say that Detlef stepped on him on accident.
Yes.
Yeah, I think he stepped on him. And I don't know if that was the killing blow or if he was already dead. I don't recall. But he definitely stepped on him.
Slipped on some Manesh.
Mm-hmm.
So Crowley starts wanting to find the evildoer. And they have some trail of blood.
Which leads them back to the room of the assistant director, Varga Bruegel, who... We have had a bit earlier where he's looking in the mirror and we establish that he, in fact, is mutated. And so Crowley bursts in and got our man. He's a mutant. He's got eyes in the palms of his hands. That's why he wore gloves the whole time. And a few other disturbing things going on in his chest.
This isn't the first time that the book talks about chaos and corruption as something fairly common. Laszlo has gone through some changes as he's been doing his thing, said something about horns growing on his head, but this is yet another case. It's also mentioned that it's related to Warpstone, or at least some of the characters mention it as related to Warpstone. So kind of a mix of a lot of later Warhammer lore that isn't quite used in the way it would be used later.
It still contextually is. If you go through the Gotrek and Felix books, you go through any of these quite gritty day-to-day material Black Library books, contact with Warpstone creates mutation, and Warpstone is potentially everywhere in small amounts. So go through the origin stories of the Beastmen special characters, the Chaos special characters, or just the background in those army books. Anyone can be born a mutant. Anyone can produce children who have mutations or are part human. How different societies deal with this, whether they kill them at birth, whether they wrap them up in a bundle and put them into the forest to die, and that's where you get Beastmen armies from. It's quite an undercurrent within societies about how do they deal with this constant problem.
Okay.
You also get nobles that go into seclusion, and they're going into seclusion because they just grew three extra eyes, and that's a bit weird.
When I was reading it, I was struck by what I perceived to be later Black Library books would have treated the subject of mutants a bit differently. Because, for instance, when Karl Franz arrives at the castle and Detlef's telling him about Bruegel and what happens with him, the notion that a mutant would immediately be put to death is not really there. Whereas I feel like later on in Warhammer lore that I read, you know, the notion that a mutant wouldn't be put immediately to death would have been, you know, like a heresy, basically, if you read like the Witch Hunter series.
Part of that could be class-based, though. Find out, I suppose it'd be about 7 years after this, Karl Franz's nephew is in fact a mutant. He isn't aware of this, but the idea of it being black and white doesn't necessarily have to exist within the nobility to the same extent that it does. Butchers just had a mutant child, chuck it down the well. So that's just European classism for you. So they have the mutant. Crelly has him tied to a chair and they torture him to try and find out why he was murdering people, which is a rather hard thing to answer because he wasn't. It wasn't him, but they don't believe him on that. Detlev eventually gets permission to have a conversation with him. They establish his innocence to some extent. Detlev is willing to put his life on the line to save his friend. Vargul won't let him do that. And we find out that Vargul, as a mutant, could firstly kill himself at any time, describes that he could use an internal set of teeth that he's mutated to destroy his own heart.
Oof, brutal.
He doesn't choose to do that. He chooses to inflate himself to break out of his own chains and then make a dash at the person who's been torturing him. Not with the intention of actually doing anything, except really scaring him to the extent that he puts his own hand in the brazier. And then he explodes himself internally, but not before wishing Detlev good luck with the play.
Yeah. Which is like a moment of levity.
Good luck with your play.
So he's tortured, and Crelly at this point thinks he's got his man, everything's A-okay. We can just go on with the play. Detlef is not convinced, and we won't be too long because thereafter Anton Vape has his moment.
So what happens after Bruegel dies is the Imperial Party kind of finally arrives, and at this point the production should be basically sewn up, ready to go. The play should be ready to be put on for all these important people and dignitaries. When Karl Franz and the other electors and other dignitaries arrive, that's basically the same time that Bruegel's funeral is going on. Lily's being kind of a pain in the production, and you have these kind of tensions amongst some of the cast. At this point, you also have Anton Veit, who's one of the very few original members of the party that came to Castle Drakenfels 25 years ago. He kind of sees what's happening to people who were original members of the party that came to Castle Drakenfels 25 years ago. He's a smart enough man to notice that all of these people are dying and their corpses are being mutilated, and it's no good being anywhere near Castle Drakenfels at this point. This place is not a happy place. So he decides that he is going to sneak out of the castle at night and make his way to anywhere else. And as he's trying to leave the premises, he is unsuccessful and is killed. And his corpse is also mutilated.
And it's his bones and his eyes. So all of them, eyes, they'd mentioned before that some people believed that if the eyes were taken, that no one would be able to see what had happened, but that some people could figure out what had happened if they could look through their eyes, see their last moments. But their eyes have been taken and Bait's bones have been taken. After the dinner, they don't know that Bait has died. And this is when Detlef and Genevieve officially get together. And this is the last moment before the play. The next thing we see is that it's time to put the play on, but there's a problem because Lily received, what is it that she receives in the box?
Vate's head, Eyeless.
Oh, she opens it and she just runs screaming. She decides she's going to leave. So she gets up and goes and she says, blaming Detlef all the way. She's done with this. And of course, Detlef now has a connection with someone that he believes should replace Lily. And he goes to Genevieve to kind of save the play and requests that she play herself, which is something he'd hinted at, is that she would do this job. And so now he asks her officially to.
We had seen clues earlier in the book that Genevieve would probably step into this role at some point.
She's been an understudy.
So the play is on and it's still going, and we get some time with Karl Franz that I thought was kind of important. He's sitting there with Oswald. He actually mentions at one moment as he looks across and sees all the elector counts, and he thinks to himself, if anything were to happen tonight, foreshadowing that something is going to happen. Of course, we all know it is. He also says to his son that you have to grow up and prove yourself and be elected first, when his son assumes that he'll be emperor someday, his father stresses that you have to be elected. So then the play is on.
And it's actually going really well. We come to find out that Genevieve had actually met up with Detlef the night before and had actually fed on him. He goes a little bit into how it makes him feel. He felt weak at first, but then he feels invigorated and he feels drawn to Genevieve. And conversely, Genevieve is able to be helped with the lines of the play. I forget how it's described, but it's more or less being able to read it through Detlef or hearing Detlef's voice in her head or something like that while she reads the lines. It, of course, builds up to the climax where Drachenfels appears.
They make it to the throne room. It's Genevieve playing herself and a dwarf actor named Guizaldo as Manesh, Detlef as Oswald, and they all enter the throne room. And I think really interesting is that moment, everything is described. It's through Genevieve's eyes. And I think the language, maybe even a direct copy of her seeing exactly what she saw before. Out the windows, you can see all the lands around the castle, Drachenfels, the little places to worship the chaos gods, just as it had been before. And that's when the throne turns.
We get to the part where we were left at the beginning of the book wondering what happens in the throne room. Earlier during the production, Lowenstein had consumed the eyes and the organs of all of the adventurers and had transformed himself into a real life mutant kind of creature of chaos, a resemblance of Drachenfels. Now he's appearing on the stage as a real terrifying thing. He's no longer Lowenstein the actor. He actually takes the actor who's playing Manesh and he throws him and he actually severs his arm. And this kind of breaks the spell. This is just a play and that you now actually have a real actor on the stage who's bleeding out of their arm. The production is now turned very serious, and this is kind of the unraveling of events. We have Oswald at this point tell the crowd to pay attention to what's going on and kind of take a more assertive role in directing events.
This is a moment when it becomes clear that Oswald is in on this.
Right. Oswald is a bad guy.
Karl Franz tries to stop him. He kind of gets up and Oswald stops Karl Franz from doing anything. It has him at sword point and is making everyone watch what's going off up on the stage as almost Drachenfels is now only needing her blood to be able to transform.
Right. So we have all the dignitaries and, you know, most important people of the empire kind of trapped in this room with an almost resumed form of the constant Drachenfels and his associate Oswald von Königswald, who's kind of brought them all here to be laid into this devious trap and presumably effect some sort of takeover of the empire if their plans can be fulfilled. But that requires the defeat of Detlef, who's on stage, and Genevieve, who's on stage at this point.
We do get two villain speeches. Oswald, why is he a villain?
It's essentially, he was jealous of Karl Franz. And that goes back to the point we brought up earlier about, I don't know if he wanted to prove himself more worthy than Karl to be. I don't know if the implication was that he thought he could be elected. I'm not really sure on that point. I don't know if anybody else recalls exactly.
Basically jealousy, though.
He basically admits that he never liked him, like hated his guts, even though Karl Franz thought they were friends.
But what is Drachenfels doing? What's his speech?
His plan, I can't do his speech off the top of my head, but his plan is to fake his own death, lie low for 20 years, gather as much of the Empire's leadership in one place as possible for his return, and cut off the head of the entire Empire in one go.
And he came up with this plan when Oswald came in. He judged Oswald correctly as a coward, as jealous, as wanting the empire for himself. And so he thought, oh, I need to get a new body anyway, because this is evidently something he has to do. He decides then to use Oswald in that way and allows Oswald to live if Oswald will do his bit.
We actually have some foreshadowing all the way back at the beginning in the prologue. Drachenfels has previously gone through a process of faking repentance in order to lull an previous emperor into full sense of security. Mm-hmm. Get him to the castle and poison everyone.
Right.
So this idea of a long play isn't out of left field. There is foreshadowing quite early on.
And 20 years to a guy that's lived for thousands of years is like a blink of the eye, you know?
So what about the fight? I mean, it's mainly Genevieve and Detlef who are up on the stage. So the only one who's a fighter there is Genevieve.
Well, not so fast, right? I mean, it's Detlef who has a fairly sophisticated education in swordcraft. I believe he's known for having studied under at least one famous fencing instructor. I mean, it's Detlef who defeats Lowenstein.
That's actually the surprise, is like Lowenstein or Drachenfels actually thinks he should be able to kill Detlef easily because can't be well trained, but Detlef actually is, as we found out at one point earlier.
Right. It's play acting as a swordsman, but at the same time it transfers some real skills apparently that he's able to use to save the day. Interestingly enough, going away from the lore where we know vampires are very powerful fighters, we don't ever get a sense throughout the book that Genevieve is really someone who's an awesome vampire lord that you would be really scared of fighting. I don't recall.
Yeah, no blender vampire here.
They talk about her heightened senses, but not necessarily, like, I don't think necessarily like her martial skill.
Best we get is the prologue again, where she steps out of the way of Uli's blade and rips his heart out.
Mm.
We never really get to that level again. In this fight, she goes into a frenzy and jumps on Drachenfels as a distraction more than anything.
No, she kind of sucks on some dust, like she's sucking out dust out of him instead of blood.
Detlev's gone down, but he manages to stagger up again, arm himself with a sledgehammer, and goes for it with that.
Right, which is important, because even though he was trained as a sword fighter, he's not able to defeat Drachenfels by the sword. He fights him for a while, and then Genevieve distracts, and then he has the sledgehammer, and that's important because...
Oh, before we get that far, there's a funny thing that Brian had noted.
Detlef proves to be a match for Lowenstein, and he says, who are you to stand against me or before me or something like that? And Detlef says, a genius, which is just so on character for him.
Yeah.
And the cool thing is, like, his original genius right before he got wrecked was that he was going to be Sigmar wailing on goblins for 2 hours.
Right.
With a hammer, and then he picks up this sledgehammer that has been left behind by the carpenter.
So he has previous job experience for this exact moment.
And he channels Sigmar, right? The thing that some people said about Oswald was that he had channeled Sigmar, or he was Sigmar in the flesh for when he defeated Drachenfels. That's actually what Detlef does.
There was a moment it talks about Detlef not really being a man of faith, but then he's like praying to Sigmar at one point.
Yeah, he evokes Sigmar. I don't think it gets to the point where maybe he hears Sigmar in his head. I don't recall if he gets that far, but he definitely evokes Sigmar. And it was actually one of my favorite parts of a book is whenever he shouts like in the name of Sigmar, or he evokes his name in front of Drachenfels. And both Oswald and Detlef did that. And both times Drachenfels, he has a composure in all of his speech, but whenever Sigmar's name is evoked, it's like the mask falls off and he starts to talk in a rage at just the name of the one who laid him low.
Yeah.
It was actually a very cool part. In my opinion.
Did you read or did you listen to the audiobook?
I listened to the audiobook.
So he channels, or how would y'all describe it as channel Sigmar? What would it be?
Yeah, channels the power of Sigmar. That's how they describe it in Luther Huss's rules, I believe.
Yeah, so he kind of fulfills his original play to some extent, the genius of his original play and what he wanted to do by Detlef filled with Sigmar. Drachenfels is defeated, and again by the same tribesman who had whooped him before, because Sigmar had been a tribesman when he defeated Drachenfels. That is the end of Drachenfels. He is defeated. The book then goes through and tells kind of what everyone did, and Genevieve and Detlef stay together until Detlef's death.
They rewrite the play. They rewrite the play to be the correct story.
What's important there as well is Oswald's fate. Right? During the course of the fight that's going on stage between Drachenfels and Genevieve and Detlef, we have Oswald in the kind of presidential box, or you know, emperor box in the theater, and he takes Karl Franz hostage by putting a knife to his neck. And then as everything turns south on stage for Drachenfels, Oswald jumps to try to make his escape from the...
John Wilkes Booth's it.
Yeah, he jumps from the box and tries to make it to the stage. And there he has a duel with Detlef, who was given a rune fang, I think, by one of the electors.
That's right. Yeah.
They have a little bit of a swordplay duel there, and Oswald von Königswald meets his end at the hands of Detlef Sirik with one of the rune fangs.
He's the one who underestimates Detlef because he thinks Detlef won't be able to fight with the sword.
I think Oswald also tries to kill Luitpold at that point, too.
But all is well, and Karl Franz lives, and the bad guys are vanquished.
Yeah, they live merrily ever after until Detlef dies. So as we close, there was one question from a user. How different is Vampire Lord in regards to the novel compared to army books? I think we discussed some of that. Is there anything we missed?
My volunteer, Carrie. Carrie, you got it.
See, the question was army books of the time. So we've covered that pretty well. If we were going to just compare it to army books of the present, then we've obviously got a lot more to discuss. But the best way to approach this is the vampire lore is completely different. Just treat it as its own thing. You get a lot about imperial society and life in the Warhammer world. This is not a good guide to what vampires are like in the Warhammer world. If you're approaching that, then Nagash trilogy and Blood of Nagash.
Thank you, user, for that question. Would anyone like to share quickly what their favorite part of the book was?
I already covered mine. It was definitely the camping trip in the woods where the electors all get told, grab your sleeping bags, we're slumming it.
Which electric count was it that was like kind of up for it, actually?
Yeah, one of them was like, oh, the woods. I love the woods.
He was like, oh, hell yeah.
was it Middenland or Nordland?
Well, and it's funny, when they reference them in the books, they don't give the names of the elector counts. I'm not sure that was established at the time. They just call them the name of their territory, you know?
Yeah, I really like that.
In my mind, Kim Newman didn't write any of the names just because he didn't want to be having to go through the lore books and try to figure them right out for himself. So he was like, I'm too lazy to do this. I'll just pick their title.
My favorite part was the kind of meta Warhammer playing with Maximilian von Königswald. You get two kind of bouts of it, and him just dying from it is also kind of poetic and also kind of terrifying.
Yeah. Anyone else a favorite moment?
I had a couple. I guess overall what I'd say is that for a book being from the late 80s, it just kind of took me to a place, even before I got involved in Warhammer, of like, just a different place of Warhammer lore that is just so different than kind of early 2000s and on, just kind of these late 80s kind of notions of vampires and chaos and Skaven and Beastmen all just kind of being these legions of bad guys who are just all kind of interconnected and not so different and distinct. And I think that's a really fun time period in the development of the Warhammer lore. And more specifically, I guess my favorite part of the book, I think, probably has to be our introduction to Detlef and his time in Munsen Keep with his fellow cellmates. I just really have an appreciation for what I consider to be like funny and smart kind of dialogue and interactions between characters. And when you're first introduced to Detlef, you're just kind of like, this guy is some weird combination of vain and funny and talented and arrogant, but also in a place where he's in a very unfortunate circumstance. And it's just, it's really entertaining. And
he's a very well-written character.
It's very well-written. And it just strikes me as kind of like a Coen Brothers kind of well-written, funny thing that I really enjoyed reading and I really appreciate it.
How about you, Ryan? Yeah.
I liked the introduction personally. I think it was just a fun, funny way to start it off with, just kind of a bloodbath as they go through this 30-page journey where everyone's dying. So it was just kind of interesting because I had all my notes and then just had to crumple them up and say, well, none of that matters. None of these people made it, or half of them made it. So I thought that was clever and fun.
Yeah, I was really confused by the introduction. I first started to try to read the book a long time ago when Ryan suggested it, and I was just not captured by it. I was just like, well, this is like the end of a story. Like, what's going on here? Like, this is just bizarre right. and out of order, and I don't get it, you know? And so I didn't really make it further. But when we were pressed into doing the podcast, I really appreciated how it all fit up.
Special mention to how many minor characters they give a send-off to in the wrapping up as what happened to them afterwards.
Oh, yeah.
So even characters who are only in it for half a page, some get mentions of, and this is the rest of their life story.
Yeah, it's definitely like an 80s movie montage at the end where, you know, they go through every random side character. They got married, all that sort of stuff.
I love when books do that kind of wrap-up thing.
That guy you didn't like became a grave robber and died horribly.
Classic. Did we want to mention anything about the end times? Should we leave that for another time?
Should I do that at the end and have an additional, if you hate end times, just leave now?
Sure.
Am I allowed to leave?
I can do it now, and then you can put it behind a firewall somewhere.
But then Mike can't leave. Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, so very quickly, within the End Times lore, Games Workshop took the opportunity to start cameoing elements of the Drakenfell story. So we get Genevieve turning up, but unnamed, as an agent of Queen Neferata, just for one page to deliver some gematics to Balthazar Gelt in a pub. But it's very clearly her. Drakenfels gets resurrected without his name, as imaginatively the Nameless. And we get Bide Nagash as one of his generals. And we get to see Drakenfels within the context of later Warhammer, just how powerful he would have been. So we've said, you know, he had armies of chaos, of orcs, of undead. He basically mind controls thousands of Imperial soldiers at the same time, effortlessly, and makes them do his bidding. But he's incredibly whimsical. He makes them start murdering each other and making banners out of their own skin and then their own bones because he thinks it's a fun idea. And later on in book five, he switched sides and immediately takes control of the entire horizon-to-horizon horde of zombies that the undead have just summoned. He is someone who, if you put him on the battlefield as described, is ridiculously overpowered, which, from the book, feels right. He feels like a character who should be almost too powerful to have on the tabletop. But yeah, that's the summary of Games Workshop brings back these characters for End Times. It's fun if you like reading the End Times, which some people do, but they really aren't for everyone, and they are a very contentious part of Games Workshop canon, or debated canon.
All right. With that, knowing that they bring some of the characters back, who are your favorite characters?
I definitely liked Detlef the most. He was vain. He was a narcissist. He brought a lot of levity, whenever there was levity, to a really well-written horror mystery novel. He was just a great character that had a lot of character development. It seemed like I enjoyed his scenes the most.
See, I quite liked Varga Bruegel. He was probably my favorite, simply because I've been in the position of producing plays in Amdram, so Amdram Dramatics, and I could really relate to just having to put up with all these personalities that you're trying to keep balanced and not killing each other backstage. Behind every Detlev, you've got the assistant who's trying to make sure he doesn't do something stupid.
True.
I like Laszlo. I thought when he got introduced, it really started to kind of ramp up the tension because it added that, like you were saying just a second ago, Brian, that like murder mystery aspect, you start to realize something more is happening. Like you kind of get the feeling as it's building, but then like you have him come in and he's so creepy. I thought he was just a really like kind of cool villain character.
Mike, you have a favorite?
Yeah, that was pretty easy to gravitate for Detlef for me, just from the standpoint of, I think he's a really well-written character and he's very funny. Has this combination of characteristics that just make him a joy to read. And I was really happy to be introduced to him after the introduction and to follow him throughout the book.
I enjoyed Rudy. I mean, I enjoyed a number of the characters, but I thought Rudy and his development, just seeing how he wanted to present himself, but how he was and how he got to where he was, and specifically when he was almost captured and had to sacrifice others to escape and all that stuff, just think it spoke to not just himself, but just the way all the characters were handled. And so I appreciated him as a character until he died.
Yeah, he seemed very real. if that makes sense. Like that would be a person. That could be a real person.
Yeah. So our next question, if you were to make a 2,500 point army from a faction in this book, or create a special character, or design a special scenario, what would it be?
So I'd go for a narrative scenario with all the special character elect accounts and probably some homebrew ones as well, forced to do a camping trip and getting ambushed by beastmen.
That'd be great, yeah.
Because who hasn't ever wanted to run that sort of 6th edition style 7-night scenario, but with all the elect accounts? So every model you have has a rune fang. They're going to go down like flies because they've got no ward save, but you're wounding automatically and ignoring armor saves on everything. It'd be hilarious.
But you're also fighting beastmen, so would they go down automatically?
They've got no armor, so half your advantage is gone.
I thought it would be cool to have like a Mordheim scenario in Drakenfell's castle. And there would be, both teams would be vying over artifacts of Drakenfels that maybe the players didn't know what they did, or it was like random. And as they picked them up and as they used them, they would get benefits and detriments that would kind of shape the outcome of the battle.
As a side note, I guess this would kind of answer the question, but it's surprising to me that Genevieve's never gotten like a model or rules like written into the game, as far as I'm aware.
I agree.
Just because it seems like, you know, they've made so many novels of her that it seems strange that they've never like actually produced anything for the tabletop for her.
It's a bit tricky because Kim Newman went on to use her in his own book series.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So the Anno Dracula books, I think there's about 5 or 6 of them. She is in that as well, but in an alternative version of our world. So whether or not Games Workshop own her or would have to negotiate with Newman about making a model for her is a bit up in the air.
Huh. Have you read any of those? Is she written the same way, or is she...
She is basically the same character. He very much transposed the same character to both.
Huh. Interesting.
Change a few names in backstory, China to Cathay, that kind of thing.
I think I'd be interested in a Laszlo Lowenstein character that starts off not super powerful, and then as the, I guess, characters of an opposing army die, he gets stronger and eats their eyes, I guess.
Yeah, that'd be an interesting mechanic.
Do we have it for those who would enjoy this book or who read this book, are there books or stories that connect to this one? I think obviously we mentioned earlier that there is a omnibus that has Genevieve Undead, Beasts in Velvet, Silver Nails, and a number of short stories, I think. What else?
I think there's a couple Warhammer fantasy RPG books I know there's at least one called Castle Drakenfels, and then I think they've done something more recently, too. I don't know if you know more about that, Carrie.
Yeah, so within Cubicle 7's been re-releasing redrafted versions of a lot of the old books. I can't remember if Castle Drakenfels has been redone yet.
It might be in the pipeline or something, yeah.
But as I mentioned right near the beginning of the podcast, the big thing they've done is redo the Enemy Within campaign, which has more or less just been rounded off. And that really does provide the how do you get from Drakenfels lore to the modern army books lore. But people who don't want to go sifting through those, there is the Prince of Altdorf's short story available for free online through Total War Access, which is an 8th edition lore story about Karl Franz trying to become emperor and the electoral process. But it has, to spoilers now, it has a different version of Maximilian von Königswald helping him become become emperor, except it turns out that Maximilian was, in fact, as Aetian, mutant the whole time and intending to get him assassinated.
It's a departure.
Yeah, so it's a complete retcon of Drakenfels that then has since been retconned, but it's free online and it's quite fun. So that's what I'd recommend as something to dip into if you want to jump easily from reading Drakenfels to reading the lore.
Okay, and we come to our last question, which is, if you are rating this book, how many eggs on Maximilian's plate out of 10 would you give it?
I gave it 10 for a Black Library book. Not even just for a Black Library book, just for just a book to read for my own enjoyment. I really enjoyed the Drakenfels character as a villain. It seems like the most compelling villains, or people say that the most compelling villains are villains that, you know, the audience can relate to, but nobody's going to relate to Drakenfels. He's truly evil. And as a truly evil character, he was very entertaining in his scenes. And I think that's really hard to do with characters who are just evil, make evilson type of villains. But I should say that, you know, Drakenfels is currently alive during the time of the Old World, so maybe his story is not finished. Maybe we'll see more to it.
Now, that'd be something.
I'd probably give it 9 eggs out of the full plate. Very enjoyable story. Probably the strongest Black Library book I've ever read. There are the missing egg is because sometimes the lore inconsistencies do take me out of it when I'm reading it. And this was true the first time I read it, and I can never quite shake that inconsistency. It's difficult to lose yourself when you're doing lore analysis automatically as you read it.
You know too much.
Exactly.
Yeah, I don't know, I'm a pretty harsh critic of things, but I mean, I really enjoyed the book. I don't know how many eggs out of 10 I would give it. For me, what was great was, I mean, the writing was fantastic. The story was wonderful. The characters were great. I also really enjoyed being taken back to a time, the late 80s, when you have one of the first Black Library books ever written regarding the Warhammer Fantasy setting, and just seeing how different things were, and just kind of trying to put myself back into the 1980s. It's like Stranger Things when those kids are playing D&D. Just different outlook on fantasy, a different perception. And you know, I everyone who knows me knows I really enjoy old models. I really enjoy beastmen. I really enjoy things like that, and just kind of these notions of how chaos has developed and how factions have developed, and how we used to have all these beastmen models with half demon, half beastmen, half skaven, half beastmen, you know, just different kinds of mutations and different kind of conceptions of beastmen and different conceptions of what, how we understand chaos and how that's changed over time. I just found it fascinating to go back and look at that and think about it and see it. And so I have a great appreciation for the 1980s things and the old things.
Evan, have you given your eggs yet?
Yeah, I enjoyed the book. There were some really good characters. The overall story, there's a twist at the end, but there's foreshadowing. You can see some of that coming. So it's not like a super out of left field twist that you don't see coming. There's portions at the towards the beginning that I thought dragged a little bit. Mostly, like, I didn't actually enjoy like the stuff before he gets to, like, they start going to the Drakenfels castle, like when he's just like writing the play and stuff. It kind of dragged a little bit for me. So I'd probably say like 7 out of 10. But I did enjoy it. It was definitely worth a read.
Thank you all who gave eggs, and to those who did not give eggs, may you have some thrown at you.
Ryan, what's your rating?
I will give it 10 out of 10 eggs, but they're half boiled. So that's effectively like 7.5 out of 10 eggs, I think is what I'll go with. I enjoyed it. I agree with Evan that there were parts that for me dragged. And it may have been because there were so many characters and you would skip around seeing each of them that maybe it did that. And although you got to see their development and got to see them later, that may have been the reason why. But I did enjoy it. I thought it was a good book. I'm really glad that we read it and read it first. It was a lot of fun, I think. And I agree that Drakenfels is a great villain, and that Detlef was a fun protagonist or fun good character. But I was surprised that Genevieve wasn't as powerful in the story as maybe you might have expected from the book being at least to some degree about her. But overall, enjoyed it. All right, well, that's all we have for today. We hope that next month you'll gather around the Hearthstone with us again.